Absolutely awesome to be here. And what I'm going to be doing over the next couple of days is spend some time in the book of Job, but taking some slightly different, approach, or approaches, should I say, to what is a complex and provocative and beautiful book. So today's session, we're going to be looking at William Blake's exposition. And just to give you a very brief roadmap in terms of this morning, welcome, guys. Sonia, you might need a handout. So just a very brief roadmap. I'm going to just offer some introductory comments, and then we'll just chat briefly about William Blake and his relationship with the book of Job. And hopefully, if I don't waffle on too long with all of that, the idea would be to leave a fair chunk of time for us to be looking at his illustrations, and hopefully we'll have opportunity to dive in fairly deeply into at least a few of those. There won't be time for us to cover all of them. So let me begin by telling a story. It's a great story about a little girl in kindergarten who was drawing a picture. Her teacher asked her what she was doing. She said, "I'm drawing a picture of God." The teacher replied, "But nobody knows what God looks like." Without missing a beat, the little girl shot back, "Well, they will in just a moment." I love that story. I think it contains a couple of truths. On the one hand, the teacher, of course, was right. Nobody knows what God looks like. And we do well to remember that our pictures and understandings of God are always inadequate. Within the Christian tradition, we believe that Christ is the revelation of God. Christ brings the image of God into sharp focus. But even 2,000 years on, we're still trying to work out who Jesus was and is. And so, in a very real sense, the teacher was right. Nobody knows what God looks like. And there's a rich tradition, the apophatic tradition of Christian spirituality, which recognizes that whatever we can say about God, even our best attempts to describe God or to try to articulate who God is fall embarrassingly short before the immensity of God's nature and being. But the little girl also was speaking a truth in that story, that there is a picture of God within all of us that we bring into focus for others in the ways in which we live our lives. And that's an important thing for us to remember. And while all of our pictures, of course, will be inadequate, the challenge for us to be thinking about is the picture of God that is within us and that we are bringing into focus for others, does it bring life or not? And that's, I think, a key question for us to hold as we look at the book of Job, and especially Blake's exposition of it. And so as we think about the pictures of God that are ours and the impact that that has on the lives that are ours, there's a lovely illustration of this in one of James Michener's novels called The Source. Some of you may be familiar with it. It describes life in the ancient Near East. And in this particular chapter, he's describing, it's a fictional account, but he's describing life in the ancient Near East. And he imaginatively presents to us a Canaanite woman standing at the door of her home, watching her husband take their newborn child to the temple to offer him as a sacrifice to the gods, because that was a requirement of their religion. And she stands there, as you can imagine, utterly bereft and devastated, watching her husband take her little boy to be sacrificed. She knew that this moment would be coming. For 9 months, she tried to prepare herself, but nothing could prepare her for the horror of that moment. A little later in the chapter, a missioner presents to us that the same woman who again is standing at the door of her home and again watches her husband go off to the temple, this time to go and have sexual intercourse with one of the cultic prostitutes that were there, because that was also a requirement of their religion. And she watches her man go to be with another woman. And just the heartbreak of that. And then she points a finger and she says of her husband, if only he had a different God, he would be a different man. If only he had a different God, he would be a different man. Now that's a story from a long time ago. But I think that all of us can recognize the truth of that. How the God that we serve shapes the people that we are. And so the picture of God that is ours is of crucial importance. And I want to suggest that in this particular moment in history in which we find ourselves, it's especially true. And so today, as we start diving into the book of Job, and William Blake's exposition, I would hope that we don't see this simply as some kind of historical study or some kind of academic exercise, but that we would recognize its importance and its currency as we think about our own ideas and pictures of God that we have and the ways in which they may well be inadequate. And so Blake's exposition of the book of Job, and I'll obviously be talking more about that in a moment, is one interpretation of the book. Let me just clarify that and express that. It's an obvious point, but I need to underscore it. This is an interpretation that Blake offers. I happen to think it's particularly compelling. It resonates with me. But of course, there are many ways in which the book of Job can be approached. There are many ways in which it can be read and understood. This is but one of those. And I want to suggest that a helpful category to think about what Blake is doing in his interpretation of the book of Job is to think and talk for a moment a little around the whole notion of religious paradigm. We're all familiar, I'm sure, with what is meant by a paradigm, a broad overarching framework, a worldview within which we make sense of our reality. A great example of how a paradigm works, and when a paradigm shifts, the implications of that would be the paradigm of geocentrism through the Middle Ages. It was an organizing framework of thinking of the world and of the cosmos where the earth was understood to be at the center of the universe. That was the paradigm. That was the big picture. How people understood reality. And then a guy called Nicolai Copernicus came along and posited a totally different theory of heliocentrism, that the sun, in fact, was at the center of the universe, or at least of the solar system. he was positing an entirely different paradigm. And it was the church that branded, that branded him a heretic. I've just gone and broken some of your equipment, Chuck. I don't know if that means that I'll ever be back, welcome back at Holden's. So,
not a problem. I might have broken yesterday.
What I'll do is, let me just do a quick wardrobe thing here and dangle that there. Does that work?
Yes.
And, okay. And so, of course, we now know that Copernicus was right, that the Earth isn't at the center of the universe, the solar system. And with that change, there was a whole new way of understanding our place within the world. The language of the old paradigm continues. Isn't that interesting? We talk of a sunrise and a sunset. We don't say, wow, that was a beautiful Earth rotation this morning. Okay? We don't say that. But we understand that there's actually, it's a different way. And so if we just think about that from the geocentric paradigm to the heliocentric paradigm, nothing else would change in terms of, you know, the day-to-day reality, but the picture with which one understood one's place, of course, shifted. Another interesting example was the whole paradigm of how disease was spread. And so before germ theory arose, there was a different paradigm. There was the miasma theory. They thought that disease was spread through foul odors. And so the precautions in terms of germ control, in terms of preventing infection, wasn't part of the medical landscape. And so you wouldn't worry about an open wound. And then, of course, with germ theory developing, the paradigm shifted. And what's interesting is that paradigm continues to develop. And so with germ theory, I've kind of got a little bit distracted here, haven't I? Let me just finish the story and I'll get back to Job. With germ theory, it was therefore thought that all germs are bad. And so you just disinfect the hell out of everything. Hey? And we realize, you know, that actually, no, we are hugely dependent upon germs and bugs and our microbiome. And as an observation of an outsider, you guys are pretty kind of intense when it comes to disinfecting stuff, you know. And I understand that within a context like this, you don't want disease to be spread. But maybe that's a paradigm that needs to be examined in terms of how many of the good bugs are also being washed away all the time. Anyhow, that's an aside. The point that I'm making is that our paradigms, these organizing principles in which we understand our reality, are hugely important. And I think that what Blake is doing with the book of Job is looking at the religious paradigm that was Job's and how that was fundamentally flawed and inadequate and how he needed to go on a journey, what I'm calling a journey of disillusionment, that ultimately led to a spiritual awakening and his religious transformation. And so, so let me give you the nutshell. That Job is introduced as this man of great piety and devotion. And the assumption is that his faith is a good thing. The Lord himself says there's no one like Job on all the earth. It's like he's a regular Boy Scout when it comes to faith and to religion and to being a devotee of God. But what if his whole framework, his whole paradigm of faith was essentially flawed? What if it was toxic? Isn't it true that if we have an essentially false picture of God, the more religious we are, the worse off we are? We see that within our world, don't we? And so Job needed to undergo a journey in which his whole picture of God and faith needed to be dismantled. And he needed to come to a new understanding. And as Blake expounds that journey, it's a journey for Job of death and resurrection. It's a journey of descent and ascent. And we see this beautifully within the illustrations. So, oh my word. Okay, let me move it up here. So, William Blake, you've got a handout and there's some introductory comments. You can read those at your leisure. But let me very, very quickly talk to him and his relationship with the book of Job. And then we're going to jump into his illustrations. So, William Blake, 1757 to 1827, an Englishman, a poet, an artist, a mystic, a visionary, and a revolutionary, in many ways difficult to understand. I certainly don't claim to be any authority on William Blake. If you would find English professors or art professors, they would be able to wax a whole lot more lyrical on him than I can. And in many ways, his thought and his work is quite dense, and it's hard to penetrate. His illustrations of the book of Job, I think, are certainly more accessible. But he was an interesting guy. For him, the imagination was absolutely key. And the flowering of the arts and how we are called as imaginative creatures to exercise this faculty and to give expression to the creative impetuses and impulses that are within us in which we have been created. And so anything that gets in the way of that, that would seek to box us in and to shackle us down, Blake was deeply critical of that. But the unleashing of the imagination and the stimulation of the imagination for us to engage within the spiritual realm in terms of who God is and our place within the world, that was what Blake was about. And what he sought to enable through his art and through his poetry, rousing the faculties to act, to engage imaginatively. And so he would be bold in inviting people to engage with his work with imagination. He resisted fixed, defined, set meanings and interpretations of his work. What his approach was to invite people in, to walk around within his work and to offer their creative and imaginative input to that. And so we can feel completely at ease to be exercising our imaginations as we engage with his work. He would be saying a rousing amen to that. And so for Blake, many expressions of religion he was deeply critical of, particularly those forms of religion that gravitated against that particular impetus and impulse of arousing the imagination. And he was particularly critical of law and sacrifice. As expressions of religious devotion, precisely because of the constraining effects that he understood them to be. And so when it comes to Blake's relationship with the book of Job, he had a long relationship with the book that spanned over 40 years. And so it was a portion of scripture that he returned to, and that he engaged with imaginatively. The illustrations we're going to be looking at occur right at the very end of his life, probably the last major published series of his. They were concluded in 1825, actually published in 1826. He died in 1827. And so it really was right at the very end of his life. And in many respects, we see in the illustrations, I would suggest, a kind of a culmination of his life's work. And that there is a deep intention that he brings, to them. And so one of the key insights that I'd like to suggest is that Blake's illustrations of the book of Job, and you've all got a copies of them, there are 21, and from early on it was recognized that the first half of the illustrations bears a relationship to the second half, and we're going to be looking at this quite carefully. As I've done work on this, I'm convinced that it's not simply a broad relationship between the first half and the second half, but that in fact the illustrations demonstrate a chiastic structure, that it's a profound chiasmus. I don't know if you're familiar with the term chiasmus or chiastic structure, but within poetry, for example, if you have, say you've got five lines of poetry, the first verse, then you've got the second verse, we call it first verse A, we can call the second verse B, the third verse C, and then the second last verse in the sequence would bear a relationship to the second verse in the sequence, often through repetition of particular words or ideas or through parallelism, and similarly the last verse bears a relationship to the first verse. And so that's what's called a very basic chiastic structure, A, B, C, B, A. And the point of a chiasmus is that the heart of the chiasmus is the key. It's kind of a fulcrum point. Now, this is a pattern that is commonly used within the poetry of the Hebrew Scriptures, and it's certainly a pattern that Blake was familiar with. And I want to suggest that his illustrations demonstrate a chiastic structure that essentially represents a journey of descent and ascent for Job. As he begins at a particular point with a particular religious consciousness, with a particular paradigm, and then he is taken down into the depths. And at that fulcrum point, he then begins his journey of ascent. And so we will see and I've tried to just demonstrate that in the notes, that there's a relationship between the first and the last of the illustrations, and between the second and the second last, and the third last. And we're not going to have opportunity to look at all of those chiastic pairings, but hopefully just a few. So let me just very quickly say that these illustrations with Blake's relationship with the book of Job, he actually produced a series of watercolors in 1805-1806, known as the Butts set. There were 19 of those. And it was based upon these that the illustrations were based. So here are just some of the images of the Butts set, since they were in color. This is the on which the first slide of the first illustration is based. This is the one on which the number 21 is based. It's great having this great big screen, hey? Isn't that awesome? And then here are just some of the others. The middle one, we'll look at that one, plate 11. This is number 14, when the angels, the stars, sang together. We don't need to worry too much about that. But the point that I'm making is that Blake then took a previous body of work and he then overlaid it with a further interpretation. And we have the illustrations as the consequence of that. So let's jump in and let me see if I can make the case for the chiastic pairings. And so if you'd like to turn in your handout And so the way, and what I've done is I've reproduced the 21 engravings within their chiastic pairings. And so they each are labeled. And so the way in which you can actually follow the sequence is if you page through your booklet and you look at the left-hand side, you'll see it goes plate 1, then plate 2, then plate 3, plate 4. And then you get to the very back page, which is the fulcrum of the chiasmus, plate 11. And then if you page back on the right-hand page, you have 12, 13, 14, all the way back to 21. Okay, so that's... So I wanted to just present them in relation to each other because we're looking at them as pairings. So if you'd like to open up to... Well, I've got it up on the board as well, but if you want to open up to the first chiastic pairing, which is of the first and the last plates within the... within the series. And so the first thing that you'll notice about these illustrations is that the original watercolors of the butt set, which form the central image, have now been embellished with what are called marginalia. The text and other sort of imagery that are in the margins around the central image. These marginalia throughout the series contain scripture references from the book of Job and elsewhere in scripture that opens up a dialogical engagement with the image and then the words of the marginalia. Some of which is kind of quite hard to make the connection, and so we have to use our imaginations. We have to work quite hard in trying to get a sense of what Blake is trying to lead us towards. But let's focus on the central images for a moment, and I'd like you to have a look at that, and just to describe, to have a look and to see what it is that you can see. So in this first image, we have Job and his wife and their 10 children all together. Job and his family. And what do you notice? What are they doing? What is their posture? What are they engaged in? Anybody, don't all shout at once, but anybody like praying, to offer praying. Something? Praying, right. What else are they doing?
Sitting.
Sitting? You're
kneeling.
Well, some are sitting. Job and his wife are sitting. The children are kneeling. What else are they doing?
Reading.
So as you look at the posture of this family, it would suggest a posture of devotion. They're kneeling, hands clasped in prayer. They've got books that are open. Presumably these are?
Scriptures.
Scriptures, right. It's a picture. Now, I've got 4 kids. And trying to get them to sit around in terms of kneeling. And I mean, it's, with 10, I'm not sure. But it seems like a pretty ideal family, hey? I mean, like, wow. So this is a picture of devotion. What else do you notice about the picture? What else can you see in it that strikes you as interesting?
Musical instruments hanging in the tree.
Right. Musical instruments are hanging in the tree. Which means that the musical instruments are unplayed. For Blake, the arts and the imagination and music and the making of music is a key part of that, but the instruments are hanging in the tree unplayed. Whatever this picture of devotion is, they are not engaging within the creativity of the arts. The instruments remain unplayed. Chuck.
Yeah, I would add too that for me there's a great sense of piety in that one on the left. He's using symmetrical balance, so everything is kind of, there's no real tension.
Right.
That there's symmetrical between the sun and the moon and the balance of the family around him, and he is the center focal point of the family. So the sort of patriarchal structure of the family.
Right.
And the one on the left, which is very different than the one on the right.
Right. Well, thank you for that. Well, let's then, that's a helpful segue. Let's then look to the one on the right And can you see the points of similarity from the first image? It's essentially a very similar composition, wouldn't you say, in terms of some of the formal structures. There's a tree, there's a family, Job and his wife, and 10 children.
There's no cathedral, though.
Yes. So now let's talk about, so what do you notice is different in terms of the one on the right? And Chuck, you were starting to go there. So yes, what do you notice?
The sun and moon are switched.
Ah. So in the first image, we've got a setting sun, which would suggest the onset of night. It is about to befall Job and his family. But in the image on the right, we have a rising sun. The sun and the moon are inverted.
Can't they be transposed?
Yeah.
Can't that be sunrise and that be sunset?
It could be, but in terms of...
Remember, you south of the equator. Things are different for you.
The sun still sets in the west. Even for us down south. So, what else do you notice that's different in terms of... what do you notice about the instruments and the image on the right? They're playing. And what are they doing? What are they doing?
They're
standing. What else?
Dancing.
Thank you. Yes, there's an element in which there's something happening. What has happened to the books? They're gone. They're gone, yes.
What about the animals? The animals
are more awake.
The animals are more awake. Yes, all of these sheep are slumbering, but now there's a sense in which something has been awakened. Whatever's happened in terms of this change within Job and his consciousness has had an impact even upon the natural order. Isn't that interesting? Now, somebody mentioned that the cathedral, the Gothic cathedral, in fact, I've actually got something quite fancy here. Let's see if this is going to work.
Only fancy if it works.
So there we go. Hey, I've got a little pointer. Can you see that cathedral? It's actually a Gothic cathedral in the background. And can you see that part of the image? Those would be storehouses for all of Job's prosperity and wealth. But those structures, those formal structures are gone within the second image. I want us just to talk a little bit about... Yes, there's a hand there. Yes.
In that first illustration, you also have all the sheep in the background.
Right.
And on the right one, you've got one sheep peering through the legs, in between the legs.
Right. There we go. Okay, and, thank you. Yeah.
And so I...
I see some more bad
children growing up.
Yeah.
A few. I mean, they're overshadowed. They're sort of blocked out.
Right. Thank you.
I have a question.
Yes?
What is the ribbon in the second picture? The ribbon there?
That's actually a musical instrument, the one in the middle over there. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, the second one. Yeah, that it's across the Job and his wife.
Oh, across the middle.
Is that what you're referring to? That's actually it's a musical instrument, and I can't remember now what it's called. It's a kind of I actually can't recall the name, but it is a musical instrument. Okay.
Well, and what looks like in front of the daughter or something, in here it actually looks more like it's a book, open book.
So, yes, I know, but it actually isn't. That central daughter is what she's holding. It is, it's kind of like a percussive instrument of some sort. I forget its name. So, I want us to talk a little bit about this Gothic cathedral. It's a very, very interesting... Within Blake's thought, he had a great respect and admiration for Gothic architecture because of the expression of creativity that it embodied. And so for him, Gothic cathedrals and architecture were often a symbol of the arts and artistic imagination. But the way I would argue, the way in which Blake uses it here at the start of the series is to subvert even his own understanding of Gothic architecture. Because while a cathedral may be this incredible expression of artistry and creativity, it remains a formal and fixed structure within which the bounds of religious faith can find its expression. And so Blake is bold in taking an image that was very dear to him, and he subverts it in saying, whatever structures we might be attached to that give to us a sense of meaning, if they become too rigid and too defined and too confining, then it's part of a paradigm that needs to actually go, and it needs to actually be relinquished. And so any form of faith that seeks to be housed, that seeks to be contained, any structures of maintaining or safeguarding or preserving one's wealth or prosperity, these are expressions of a rigidity, of a way and a mode of being within the world that ultimately is toxic and that needs to be undone. Yes,
Peter. It seems like the marginalia in the last plate kind of echoes that. It's in burnt offerings for sin, thou hast had no pleasure.
Right, right.
So that's kind of an echo of saying those structures of righteousness aren't really the best expression of faith.
Right, or, absolutely. Spot on. And so whilst there's an altar at both, there's a sense in which, and in the first one, the letter killeth, the spirit giveth life. So if you're following the dictates of formalized religion and the letter of that in terms of the sacrifice that you must offer, remember, I'm going to come to you in a moment, Chuck, let me just finish this thought. Remember that in the text of Job, the first words that we hear from Job in 1:5, is when he makes sacrifices on behalf of children, of his children, they would have a party in each of their homes, and Job would be absolutely beside himself with anxiety in case, and we read in 1:5, he says, it may be that my children have cursed God in their hearts. And so he would offer preemptive sacrifices just in case his children did something wrong while they were having one of their parties. It's a picture of control. It's a picture of anxiety. It's a picture of trying to hold together his world, even the way in which his whole estate is described. 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels, 500 oxen and 500 donkeys. It's a very precise picture. And that is called to actually be blown apart in terms of the journey that will be his. Chuck, sorry, you had.
Yeah, I think I was tracking with that, and I think in the story for me that those structures fall on the left, but in the healing of Job, it's really occurs somewhere in that imaginative cosmic journey that God takes Job on
right.
to show him anew.
Absolutely.
Right. So in that cosmic journey, he is somehow healed and he begins life again. So for me, the plate on the right is really about creation, God's creation, that all elements are sacred and that is the cathedral. Oh,
beautiful, absolutely beautiful. So the cathedral of creation, that's a lovely thought. Thank you for that. We could spend the whole session just on this, but I'd like us to now move to plate number 11, which is on the back page. Which is the fulcrum point. And so this, in a sense, bookends the journey in terms of where Job begins and to where he ends. And I know that I haven't really articulated the content of those particular paradigms. But let's move to, let's jump ahead to the turning point within the series, which is this kind of scary picture at number 11, okay? And being the fulcrum point, there's no parallel image. This one stands on its own. This is the hinge point in terms of the journey. And so in this image, and again, if you want to just take a moment to have a look at it, so in this image, we have a supine Job lying on his bed with this divine figure hovering over him. There was another painting that Blake did, let me just go forward to that, that bears a remarkable affinity to this image. It's a painting from 1795, Elohim creating Adam. Mm-hmm. Can you see the similarity? Mm-hmm. And so, but what do you notice about this particular image?
Well, the serpent's around that, the angel, or instead of around Adam.
Right.
This one has... You don't have a side by side up there, Rogers.
I don't. But there we go. Let's look at this figure of it's not an angel. It's a representation of God. But can you notice? Look at God's feet. What do you notice? What do you notice?
Or are they talons, like a bird?
No, those are... It's a cloven foot. And God is encircled by a serpent. Ooh, this is getting a little bit uncomfortable. Blake is presenting a picture of God as a demonic entity. I know we don't necessarily, I don't know about you guys in terms of the Lutherans, but sort of the language of demonic is not really a huge part of the language, but there's a sense in which Blake has been very clear that God is being represented in unmistakably demonic categories. The cloven hoof in terms of the feet, and encircled with the serpent, and so there's something terrifying about this divine presence, and this God whom Job has been serving. And the two arms of God, the right arm of God, is pointing to stone tablets, which would be the Ten Commandments. And the left hand is pointing to the fires of hell. It would seem that God, or this God, a connection is being drawn between, and we must be careful here in terms of the stone tablets as a representation of law in Blake's understanding of what that means. And the connection of the fiery pit of hell. Yes, there's...
Is he pointing also to a cross that's over there stuck on the side at the top? There's a cross in there, almost up here.
Do you want to use the pointer?
Right here.
That's part of the cross.
Well, that's an interesting observation, but what is the position in which this divine, the God is assuming? It's a cruciform position. We don't have time to look at this, but if you page through the illustrations and you see the occurrence of cruciform positions, particularly in the person of Satan, we need to have a sidebar about Satan in a moment and how Blake uses him. But God is presented in a cruciform position. There's a parody of the crucifixion going on here. And we've got these three demons, which would be representations of Job's three friends, that are seeking to drag him down into the fiery pits of hell with chains and with bondage. And so the point at this is the nadir of the journey, this is the bottom point of the journey, is that Job is suddenly seeing the God that he's been serving, and it is revealed to be a devil. That the God of his pietistic devotion, that we would all say, so wonderful that you are so religious, he suddenly realizes, oh my God, what I've been serving has been fundamentally false. And so there's a disillusionment that's happening here. Now the word, that's what I titled the session, how are we doing? There's a disillusionment that's happening here. The word disillusion talks about the disappointment of what we thought was and now isn't, and expectations that have been dashed and disappointed. But the word disillusion quite literally means the removal of illusion. And so there's a sense in which Job has to undergo this necessary journey of disillusionment for his illusions of who God is and what faith is actually about to be deconstructed, to die, so that there might be a resurrection to something new, which we see at the culmination, a new way of actually being before God. Not the God of law and hell as a consequence. And the entire paradigm with which Job and his friends is grappling is, well, how can all of these sufferings happen to me if I've been so pietistic and so devoted? And it doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up. Within that paradigm, there's something fundamentally off. And so his whole picture of God has to be exploded, which is what happens within the divine speeches, as he comes to a radical new picture and understanding of God and his place within the world. So any comments around that? And then we'll see what we can look at in terms of some other chiastic pairings. So that, what I've just described, is the broad framework of the journey, the beginning and the end and the fulcrum point. But in each of the chiastic pairings, there are layers of this journey as Job has to descend through his experiences of suffering and engagement with the friends, and then through his subsequent ascent, through his encounter with God, particularly in the whirlwind speeches. So this is the broad framework, and then we're going to hopefully get into a little bit more of the detail. Yes, there's two hands. There's one over there, and then coming to you, Peter.
So is the matching of that text with that image, is the big, like, I know my Redeemer liveth, is that post-paradigm of God expulsion or pre-paradigm?
Wonderful, thank you. So we've got here in the marginalia this reference from Job 19, one of the most famous passages. I know that my Redeemer lives, and Handel, I'm not going to burst into song to offer a rendition, you'll be glad to know. And so even as Job reaches the bottom point of this journey of disillusionment, there is already the hint of something new and transformed that is coming. And so he says, for I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand in the latter days upon the earth. And after my skin destroy thou the flesh, shall I see God, whom I shall see for myself. At the end of the book, he says, I had heard you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. The sense in which is, and again, what's happening again within Blake's thought is that this is a vision that Job has. It's the first vision that he has within the series. And visionary insight is what Blake would be calling forth. And what's going to happen in the second half of the series would be further visionary encounters with God and with the wild beauty of creation, in which Job's eyes come to see not just God, but his place within the cosmos and faith in a whole new way. And so my eyes shall see for myself, and mine eyes shall behold and not another, though consumed be my wrought image. So there's a sense, and what is a wrought image? It's part of the idolatry that we are told and guarded against. So though that gets consumed, yet now he knows that there's this hint to the promise of resurrection. So beautiful observation. Thank you so much. Peter.
Yeah, and I can talk with you afterward about this if it takes us too far away from where we're going, but I'm just hearing in a lot of the language and a lot of the interpretation, which is really beautiful, and I think it's really appropriate that it's coming, you know, by way of Blake and by way of us from a Christian perspective. But I'm wondering if there's commentary on Blake's work from a Jewish perspective.
Right.
Because yeah. I think, you know, our lens is bringing our Christian story to this, and I think really appropriately and beautifully. But I also wonder, you know, are there Jewish responses to Blake?
Or, right. It's an excellent question, Peter.
And we can talk about it offline.
Sure, but perhaps it's a very quick response, which is important, in that Blake is unashamedly this interpretation of the book of Job is absolutely placed within a broad Christian framework. In the second half of the series, as Job encounters God in the whirlwind speeches, for Blake it's an encounter with Christ.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so the whole place of Christ within that journey is front and central. So in that regard, it is very clearly a Christian exposition, an imaginative exposition. But that's a helpful observation. Okay, so shall we look at maybe, I want us to look at, if you can turn to plates 2 and 20. And we'll just see how far we get. Do you know what? We'll come back to this one if there's time. But I think let's look to plates 8 and 14. Because it's probably a more crucial illustration of the journey of descent and ascent. So, in plate 8, this would be informed by chapter 3 of the book of Job. Now, and I recognize the fact that I haven't done much in terms of setting the scene in terms of the text, the biblical text of the book of Job. So for those of you who are not particularly familiar, the first two chapters of the book of Job is part of what's called the framing prose, the prologue, which then gets, and then moves to the epilogue, the latter part of chapter 42. And then the central portion of the book from chapters 3 to 42 verse 6 is primarily in poetry. And chapter 3 marks the beginning of that. And after Job's initial response of pietistic devotion in response to the tremendous calamities that he'd suffered, the loss of all of his property, the death of 10 children, where he responds by saying, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I shall return. The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord," which has always been understood as like, wow, what faith! What faith! To be able to respond to such suffering with such devotion to God. The question is, which God? And if that's a false God, then is Job's response in fact healthy? And what Blake is saying very clearly is that it's not. He actually needs to, he needs to undergo this journey of disillusionment and transformation. And so in chapter 3, Job then erupts from this initial posture of patience and pietistic devotion. Whatever happens, it's kind of like happy thoughts, you know. He kind of erupts. And the question within the prologue is whether or not Job is going to curse God. And in chapter 3, it begins, Job cursed not God, but the day of his birth. And he then goes into this amazing rant, this lament. And we don't have time to really unpack in detail what happens in chapter 3. But essentially, he's saying is that, let the day perish wherein I was born. He's, let the divides between day and night kind of be taken away. What Job is saying in his lament in chapter 3 is, let creation be undone, essentially. Let creation be undone. And it arises out of, at the end of the prologue, when his three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, arrive. We read that they sit with him in silence for, remember how long?
Seven days.
There's an echo of God speaking creation into existence through God's spoken word over the 7 days of creation. But now in the light of Job's suffering, they sit in silence with him for 7 days. And there's almost a sense in which the text is suggesting, and certainly the way in which Blake uses it, is that what is going to be created here? And as he erupts into his lament in chapter 3, he's effectively cursing creation. So does he actually curse God? Well, not quite, but he's kind of coming close. And there's a sense in which he's wanting to undo creation because he recognizes that it actually doesn't work. Mm. This paradigm doesn't work. And so this disillusionment is happening for him. And he's saying the only way out here is for the plug to be pulled on the whole damn thing. Sorry, I'm not supposed to say those words on the recording. Sorry, Chuck. But that's the sense in which what he's feeling. And then as we look at the chiastic pairing on the journey of ascent, and we could speak more about that, but let me move on. This comes out of the divine speeches. And if you look at the marginalia in particular of this plate number 14, what do you notice within the margins?
The creation story.
Yeah. The creation story. We're taken back. So they sat with him for 7 days and seven nights. And not a word was spoken. And now we are taken back into the creation story. And this tour of creation on which God takes Job, in which he utterly explodes his picture of the world and his place within it. Now we could spend an entire session on the divine speeches. And I'm kind of thinking now maybe I sort of should have suggested that in my teaching plan. But what we see in the divine speeches from chapters 38 through to the end of chapter 41, it actually occurs in two divine speeches. And the first of which is that God takes Job on this tour of creation of the cosmos, in which there are cosmological and meteorological and zoological exhibits on display, as it were, in which God speaks about the very structures of the cosmos, the storehouses of rain and snow, and then takes him on this tour of the world and the realm of wild animals. And the point of that divine speech is this. And I know I'm giving it very short, a very brief treatment. But the point of the divine speech is, or one of the points is this, is that there is a wildness to this creation that is utterly beyond Job's ability to control and to define. The animals are all wild animals that have their existence with absolute disregard to the realm of humans. We read in chapter 1 that he has 500 oxen and 500 donkeys, domesticated animals as part of his estate. Very neat, 500 of each. In the divine speeches, we meet the wild ass and the wild donkey that can't be tamed. And so it continues, the celebration of the wildness, the fierceness of creation that's utterly beyond Job's ability to control or to regulate. And it's out of that exposure, and Chuck, you were making a reference to it in an earlier comment, in terms of this expansive view of this world that God has made, which is certainly not safe. And yet there is an order to it, not the kind of rigid order that was part of Job's whole worldview before, but there's a beautiful order of flow within the wildness and the fierce beauty of creation. And that this is part, a necessary part of Job's ascent. And so let me push pause and ask, are there some comments and observations that people would like to make around that chiastic pair, which is an important one in terms of the place of creation within Job's journey of disillusionment, his death, and subsequent resurrection. Any comments or observations? Chuck?
Oh, I was going to say the plate before this, when the dream is occurring, that it's like the ascent occurs even in spite of himself. That, like for me in that dream, it goes back to the text that God and Satan make a wager.
Right.
Right, that will Job do this or not do this? So, but in that descent, there's still sort of, I see both of those images of both Satan and God sort of wrestling. Job sort of being in a state of sleep, but then that ascent begins in spite of himself, right? I don't know that he did anything to bring him to that ascent.
Right, right.
Other than just being and yes, God took.
Yes. And so there's the sense in which, within the text of the book of Job, we have this long section of this dialogue of speeches between Job and the three friends, from chapter 4 right through to chapter 27, essentially, which eventually breaks down. This attempt, this human attempt to make sense of what had happened. And it's an attempt that comes out of this particular paradigm, which Job's friends, in fact, share. They come at it from different sides. You must be at fault, Job, because of the suffering. Something you've done something to deserve this. Job says, no, I know that I'm innocent. But they are all operating out of the same paradigm. And eventually that necessary engagement breaks down. It eventually ends in futility. It's a necessary conversation to have, but it will not actually get Job there. And he comes to that point, that low point, where it's basically his everything stripped away. He's got nothing left. And then this resurrection happens, which of course is part of our Christian understanding. Jesus didn't raise himself. God raised Jesus from the dead. Jesus had to die and surrender to death. And then God raised him. And so there's a similar thing that I'm hearing what you're saying in terms of Job's journey. Thank you.
Yeah, yes, Janine.
So what I notice in this, back to the 8 and the 14, that is this really strong sense of Job, and I think that probably his wife and his three friends being contained within something where, like a small part contained within God and the cosmos, where in the beginning, like, Job was contained in things. You know, his religion was contained, and then not, like, his wealth was contained again. You know, thinking that he was that. So that shift in who the owner, who the creator, who the great mind was, and the shift from Job to this containedness is what strikes out.
Thank you for that. But can you also see, though, that there is that there's a sense of boundedness, but there's also it also exceeds those bounds. So if we go back to this image on which this plate plate 14, this was the original watercolor, and you can see obviously the strong similarities, but I want to point out just one little change that Blake makes in the subsequent illustration. We've got these angels, four of them at the top, but if we go to whatever slide number this is now, not that one, there we go. Can you see that there's actual extra arms that now kind of go beyond the image? It's kind of like these the song of this angel, angels goes, extends beyond the parameters of the image. So there's just like a little subtle clue to the expansiveness of this picture that Job is being invited into. Any other comments? We've got a few more minutes. Let's quickly, so we've started looking at the divine speeches in plate 14. Let's look at plate 15 and its corresponding parallel in number 7. And plate 15 has to do with the second divine speech and the Behemoth and Leviathan. And the beautiful thing about the pairing of these two is that in plate 7, it's entitled Job's Comforters. As the friends come, having heard of Job's calamity, they come to offer their solidarity with him in his suffering. This is picking up at the end of the prologue. But as they turn out to be very sorry comforters indeed. And what Blake is suggesting is that there are actually some other comforters for Job. In the creatures, the Nopar creatures, of Behemoth and Leviathan. Maybe we can just take a short moment to talk about these, because this is also such a crucial part of the text, the biblical text. And so, these strange creatures, which are represented here as a kind of a Behemoth, as a kind of hippopotamus, and Leviathan as this sort of sea creature, kind of a crocodile, but it's not a crocodile. I think that's an inadequate representation. These are creatures, but maybe also primordial beings, kind of mythological. There's an ambiguity in terms of their identity. And what's significant about them is that within the chiastic pairing, if they are being offered and presented to Job as comforters for his condition, well, in what way does that then operate? You see, and let's focus on the creature or the being of Leviathan. Leviathan is a creature, is a mythological being that we encounter in numerous other places within the Hebrew Scriptures. And also within the book of Job. Job makes reference to Leviathan, I think it's in chapter 7.
And Leviathan was this sea monster. Within the thought world of the ancient Near East and the creation stories that were told about how the world came into being, many of those stories, the Babylonian creation story called the Enuma Elish, where the god Marduk fights with Tiamat, this sea monster of the salt ocean, and slays Tiamat. It's similar within the Canaanite creation story of Baal and Yam, Yam being a word for the sea. It was a well-established trope, a well-established symbol within the ancient Near East of this being, this sea monster, this dragon, representative of the tumultuous oceans that needed to be defeated in order for creation to occur. And so throughout the Old Testament, Leviathan is always presented as anti-creation and as the nemesis of God. That God needs to somehow, if not defeat, at least contain, because it represents this chaotic force that can threaten life and the order of life. And in the divine speeches, that is completely blown apart. It's completely blown apart. You know, back in South Africa, we have what are called praise singers. And when Americans come to some kind of cultural gathering and there's a praise singer, it's kind of like, it's quite fun to, you see the wives sort of huddling up to their husbands, like, we're going to die. Because a praise singer would come out like in a little leopard skin and brandishing a sword and a spear and would start like yelling and screaming and stamping in a language you don't understand. But it's a well-established tradition of singing the praises of the king, as it were, of extolling the greatness of the ruler, of the chief. And there's a sense, as scandalous as this sounds, that God assumes the role of praise singer of Leviathan. I mean, it's completely scandalous. This is God's arch enemy. But you can go and read in chapter 41, he talks about Leviathan. I'll pick up the story in verse 12. He says, I will not keep silence concerning its limbs or its mighty strength or its splendid frame. Who can strip off its outer garment? Its back is made of shields in rows. From its mouth go flaming torches. Out of its nostrils come smoke. It's like God can't, it's like the words just tumbling out. Have you seen this guy? It's like, wow! It's like amazing! He's like singing his praises. Leviathan, who is always regarded as God's enemy, as opposed to creation, as embodying the forces of chaos. And here's God saying, no! This is amazing. This is awesome. It's God saying, like, the Ark of the Holy extends way wider, Job, than what you think. And under the Ark of the Holy, everything belongs. And so as a consequence of this, there's this invitation into this radically different way of viewing the world. Because if God is utterly unintimidated by this creature that is supposed to be God's arch enemy, it suggests a very different picture of the world, in which there is space for even the chaotic and the unruly and the wild and the dangerous, but not without its bounds. And that offers the comfort that Job then needs. And while there's no answer to the specific details of his particular circumstance and his particular suffering, out of this expanded picture of the cosmos and how God views things, there is a sense in which Job finds resolution. So let me push pause there. I don't have any comments or
And I'm suddenly realizing that we're kind of dancing around the video, which is fine. It doesn't have to be all rigid and ordered. And maybe you kind of completely, I don't know if I've, you know, if you're tracking, but we've, I know that the bell's gone for lunch. So maybe, I know we've got just a few minutes, and I don't know if there's any comments or questions. I'm realizing that in many ways there's so much that's inadequate in terms of what I've attempted to present today, but hopefully you've caught at least a glimpse. And of course, what I'd invite you to do is that we'll be moving on from Blake in terms of what I'm going to be doing over the next couple of days. But what I'd invite you to do is to sit with these images and to look at them and to see and to go through them in their sequence 1 to 21 and to see this journey of descent and ascent, and then to also look at them in their chiastic pairings and to see how they inform and talk to one another. But let me, any comments, any observations?
You spoke to Leviathan, what about Behemoth?
Yes, so Behemoth is, so a similar thing is going on there. The word Behemoth is the actual Hebrew, it's like the plural of majesty. It kind of represents like this landed creature that kind of hangs out in a wadi. And so it's almost like a representation of, we don't find Behemoth, the name Behemoth, elsewhere in the Tanakh, in the Hebrew scriptures, but it's almost like this embodiment or this representation of kind of like landed creatures. But again, it's almost like a foil into Leviathan, which gets the most airtime in the divine speeches. So they kind of go together, but the real punch comes in the accounts, in the treatment of Leviathan, because of the established association of what Leviathan represented.
Yes. These last couple of images, 15 and whatever the previous one was, there's a God figure and a Job figure that look very much alike.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
And
yeah.
I'm just wondering if, you know, I'll look at them in more detail in the whole works, but it feels like the image of God sort of growing into Job.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Sure. And I mean, and of course the representation of God throughout the illustrations, in terms of, if you look at the God of the earlier parts of the series, visually there's a similarity. Not a similarity, God is represented in the same way with this kind of long beard and all of that. But clearly the God, and in fact that was the one which we didn't get to. The second image of God on the throne with a book that's open in his lap. And there's a whole lot of bookish activity going on. Job and his wife, they look at the book, like, where does it say, you know, have my children sinned, have they cursed God? And there are these angels that are flying around bringing scrolls and books. And God is presented as this divine bookkeeper, this divine accountant, mm-hmm. Kind of keeps track. And what's interesting about that, and of course that representation of God is similar to, so we've got to navigate, well, you know, so which one is this? And the resonance between the imagery of God and Job is saying, well, we're created in the image of God. Is that something that comes to be brought to bear? What's interesting about this image, number plate 2, is that out of all of this bookish activity, there's a sense in which the gate is opened for Satan. And we didn't have the sidebar about Satan. I'm sorry, I ran out of time about that. Because Blake is clear. And he uses, whilst the Hebrew doesn't refer to Satan as the late development of like the devil, it's clearly ha-satan in the Hebrew. It basically means the accuser, or kind of the prosecuting authority. Blake is very clear in terms of utilizing the image of Satan within the Christian understanding of like the devil. And what's interesting is that this bookish activity opens the gate for Satan to kind of now begin to do his work. And you'll see in the marginalia, we've got this shepherd and a shepherd and a shepherdess, if that's the word. But there's this, which are representations of Job and his wife. But there's this gate, the sheepfold, but the gate is open. And so the appearance is given of sanctuary and of security, but in fact there's a vulnerability. And the kind of, and it centers on their children. And so while Job thinks that he is protecting his children, in fact it's going to be revealed in just the very next image that actually no, that there's a vulnerability here. That your insistence upon a bookish understanding of faith and religion is ultimately inadequate. And then this, this is a beautiful part in terms of Job's restoration of his daughters. But we don't have time. We don't have time to talk about that now, unfortunately. I think we're done. So thank you for bearing with me through that session. So tomorrow I'll be looking at Job's wife in particular, coming out of the Blake illustrations, but we'll be moving on from these. So thanks everybody.
Thank you.